morning. This is case number 09-SC-263, Holland versus Steele. Are both parties ready? I see Mr. Mann.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're ready, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm John R. Mann, Kenny Childs and Partners, registration number 160088 for the petitioners, Catherine Allen and her professional corporation. Like the last case, we don't have a lot of factual findings. This case is really presents pure questions of law, both in the de novo standard of review for a Rule 12b-5 motion and for the existence of a duty on the part of an attorney toward a non-client. And what the issue in this case is whether an attorney who allegedly negligently furnishes information about a non-client's case to the non-client can be held liable for the full value of that underlying case when it is lost, in the same manner as if the attorney had actually undertaken to represent the client in that case. I think we start with the, I mean, it's a given in this case that there was no attorney-client relationship between the Steeles and Ms. Allen. And because, this, as this court has repeatedly held, a professional malpractice claim may be asserted only by a client, that claim is unavailable to the Steeles in this case, as there is no contractual basis for imposing a duty of professional care on Ms. Allen toward the Steeles. The Steeles complaint thus states a claim only if there is some other common law tort theory under which Ms. Allen may have owed them a duty of care. The complaint here appears to be drafted with the intent to establish professional liability to a non-client in the absence of an attorney-client relationship, essentially to determine what are the minimum facts necessary to establish an attorney's duty to a non-client. Now, it's tempting to say, well, there's never any liability on the part of an attorney to a non-client, but liability has been recognized by this court in certain circumstances, including the Mahaffey case, based on the tort of negligent misrepresentation. This is a tort duty that arises independently of the attorney-client relationship, and it arises at common law rather than from the contractual relationship between the attorney and client. And it arises from a duty to use due care in providing information to people who may foreseeably or knowingly use that information in a business transaction, where reliance on the information is either intended or invited. It differs from the attorney's obligation based on the contractual undertaking because it is much more limited in its scope.
Mr. Mann, can I just, you all have too much time, and I think it's an important issue, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but I am.
Please.
The allegation is made that it's a business transaction, and we have notice pleading. So, and there's no fact, there are no facts. I mean, we looked at the complaint, and that's it.
That's it.
So it could have happened anywhere.
Well,
we don't know that. Let's assume it did happen.
Assume the facts.
They went down to your office and you gave them this bad advice.
Yeah, and
that's a business transaction, isn't it?
It probably is. But the question is, I do want to talk about Section 15 of the restatement. But yeah, that's a business transaction, sure. But the question is, in the negligent misrepresentation context, the plaintiff is usually induced into a business transaction by the negligent misrepresentation and then comes back later and says, hey, the information you gave me was bad. Based on your opinions or your analysis or your representations, I invested in this investment. I purchased these goods. I lent money to this debtor, all in reliance. And here, there's no inducement.
Well, isn't there an inducement implied by the nature of the advice, the bad advice? You don't have to do anything because it's okay. You know, you got to do this other stuff.
But you see, that's different from the negligent misrepresentation context because in that context, the plaintiff is induced to actually do something, to spend money, to invest money, to lend money, whatever the situation may be. The client is induced and does enter into a contract either with the defendant or with a third party. That didn't happen here.
It's an omission, though.
It's an omission, but
on the part of a client, a prospective client.
Well, but is that is that actual negligent misrepresentation? Let me give you an analogy. Let's say an attorney issues an opinion letter and says there's a risk to this transaction, and as a result, the target, the prospective investor, says, well, I'm not going to invest money in that transaction. I'm going to forbear based on that reliance. Then it turns out that the investment was great. They would have made 500%. Do you think that person could come back and tell the person who said there's a risk, oh, well, you said there was a risk, and it turns out that if I'd invested in it, I would have made 500 times my investment. You're liable for that. So I think that's a different kind of situation where you actually induce someone to enter into a transaction, and you maybe induce someone to forbear. So that's just one way it differs from the Mahaffey situation. But I want to talk about, I guess my concern here is really with the Court of Appeals' reliance of Section 15 of the Restatement Third, just because if this case is going to proceed as a negligent misrepresentation theory, Section 15 is really irrelevant, because the duty that is owed here, at least the duty to furnish, to use reasonable care to furnish information for use in a business transaction, is governed by Section 552 of the Second Restatement, again, which was referenced by this court in Mahaffey. And you don't need to, that provides the framework for the duty. You don't need to invoke this section of the Restatement Third on duty to prospective clients. And the reason that really has me concerned is that that's really what the Restatement Third has done, is created a new rule of law. It doesn't view the attorney, the client, non-client relationship as a binary thing anymore. I mean, in Mahaffey, this court said, well, there's an attorney-client relationship, you can't sue for malpractice. Under Section 15 of the Restatement, the absence of an attorney-client relationship is not a bar to an action for professional malpractice. Section 15 clearly, and Section 51, where that says that it can be a actionable tort.
Well, it looks like a pretty good framework to me.
Well,
just for sake of argument now, I'm asking you the following question. I mean, legal advice was given.
Yes.
That misled these folks.
But there was no attorney-client relationship.
Well, but why was the legal advice given then?
Well, that's quite often the case, is that when attorneys have a first meeting, let's assume that it's the situation of they come to the attorney's office, sit down, talk about the case, they ask some questions, they get some information, leave, no, never come back, no attorney-client relationship is formed. Now, the Section 15 statement would say, well, there's kind of a gray area there. It's not a binary. It's not, you know, they're not a non-client, they're not a client, they're this gray area prospective client, and so there's a duty owed. And that's really a radical departure from the pre-existing law, both under the Restatement and in the state. And I guess the point is that the Court of Appeals did not need to consider that, because the professional negligence claim was dismissed. It was not appealed to the Court of Appeals. It's not before the case. The only claim is before the court below was the negligent misrepresentation claim. And to find a duty of care under negligent misrepresentation, I'll concede that, yes, there is a duty to furnish accurate information on the part of a lawyer. And it's a professional duty, too. So that the existence, the court didn't need to rely on that part of the restatement to find a duty for the negligent misrepresentation claim. And my concern is just that it has brought in this possibility of non-clients suing for professional negligence, which is really a radical departure from the law of this state.
But the advice is, you have a 5-year statute of limitations. This person presumably relies on it. I mean, you know, at least those are the alleged facts, and is out of court based on an attorney. Isn't there some implied duty when you give advice, anytime you give advice and somebody goes and acts on it? I mean, don't you usually say, I need to research this, you retain me, I'll look into what the statute of limitations is?
In that case, I think there would be an attorney-client relationship. I think that when you get that far, maybe there's an argument that an attorney-client relationship existed, but that claim is not made in this case.
Isn't Section 15 discussing exactly this situation, though? I mean, even one of the examples it's used is the statute of limitations context.
And
it's been around since 2000.
But do you really want to say, and this is really why They have not stated a claim for negligent misrepresentation. It's in the nature of the remedy claimed. They're not claiming, oh, we lost money out of pocket in Reliance. You're saying we made a bad investment or we bought something that wasn't what it was represented to be. What they're saying is because you, who are not an attorney, with whom we had no attorney-client relationship, told me that the statute of limitations, allegedly said the statute of limitations was 5 years. You're liable for the failure of our case. The attorney had, and this is not an instance where the duty, the liability imposed, is commensurate with the undertaking by the lawyer. The lawyer did not undertake to manage that case or to handle that case, and yet the plaintiffs want to hold the lawyer liable for the loss of that case, just as though the lawyer had undertaken to represent the case, had undertaken to act for them, and had somehow missed the filing date by limitations. It's the exact same result. But that, in the second situation, the lawyer undertakes responsibility for the case. In the situation here, the lawyer did not undertake any responsibility for the case.
What's the specific element of the tort that's missing, in your view?
The nature of the damages claimed.
The claim.
Yes.
Because it doesn't differ from the fundamental malpractice.
So you guys, the damages here do not differ from those claimed for legal malpractice.
Well, how about, your adversaries cite that the modern trend is to use a fact-specific test that is sort of the implication of both Justice Rice and Justice Hobbs were asking is that it's not really a good idea to have lawyers run around, even in a non-client situation, giving improper, incompetent advice. And that we as a profession, as a modern profession, have a duty of responsibility to act responsibly, even to those that don't formally retain us.
Well, the problem you have then, because one of the factors in the duty analysis is the consequences of imposing the burden on the defendant to guard against harm. And I think if you're going to hold listen, it's quite common for attorneys to offer free advice at a prospective meeting with a client just to say, let's see if you have a case.
Usually that indicates that the attorney has a financial interest in the client's case.
Well,
right?
And for the purposes of Section 552 on negligent misrepresentation, the fact that you meet in that context is enough of financial interest that it's in your course of profession that a duty is owed. Okay, I'm not disputing that. But the problem is by putting this burden to say to lawyers, if you make a mistake giving advice or citing a statute to a non-client, you're going to be liable for the full value of their case, even though you had nothing more to do with it. That's really going to chill.
Why couldn't you just say, the lawyer just say nothing or be equivocal or something along those lines? I mean, we know so few facts about this case, it's hard, but at least the way it seems to me from reading all the brief, this particular lawyer made a definitive statement. You have to exhaust certain things first, and the statute of limitations is X, and that's the way it is. Is that, I mean, that, I don't know whether that's right, but that's the way I understand the limited facts in this case. All right, let's assume so. So those are definitive statements, which if I'd been a prospective client, and I would have said, well, you know, I don't really have to do anything for a little while here, so maybe I won't.
But do you really want to say that lawyer is going to be responsible for all the damages that could have been recovered in that case? I mean, this is a policy question, as are all duty questions. And really, do we want to say that a lawyer who only gives advice and does not undertake responsibility for the handling of the case is going to be responsible for the full lost value of the case? And I think that's really the question that's presented.
Well, counsel, can I just follow up on that? Do you think that that's actually true? I mean, what do you base that on, that the full value of the case has to be assessed against the attorney?
Well,
excuse me just for a minute. Mr. Mann, let me just interrupt you. This case has only been set for 15 minutes, and we think it's an important case. And so we'll extend the time for both sides to have the court answer questions, and we'll give that. So go ahead. I'm sorry. Answer.
I base this on paragraph 15 of the complaint, which states the damages plaintiffs had general and special damages, including by way of illustration, without limitation loss in the value of their claims against the motorist legally liable for damages arising from their online collision. Now, that doesn't seem to me to be a claim for out-of-pocket damages that are allowed as a measure of damages for negligent misrepresentation. That seems to be a measure of damages based on the expectancy interest, as though the Steeles had entered into a contract with Miss Allen and Miss Allen had somehow misrepresented, negligently induced them into entering into that contract.
But this is in fact a different tort, negligent misrepresentation, as opposed to malpractice. And so this complaint is all we have, and I think we're both struggling with that. So it's really hard to say what the measure of damage would be. I mean, that obviously would be a question that the trial judge would have to decide.
I would probably agree with that.
Yeah. So really the question we want to focus on, I think, or I do, is duty.
Yes.
And if you could just get back to this whole duty risk analysis. I mean, my concern is that there's so many easy ways to equivocate or say, I'm not sure, or let me look into it, or those kinds of things. But at least as we've agreed to accept these facts, it seems a very definitive statement.
It would be great if lawyers would say, well, I'll get back to you, or I'll answer that if you form an attorney-client relationship. But the fact is they don't. A lot of lawyers are free with advice, and they tend to view everyone as a prospective client. I mean, that's the...
That's sort of the problem, isn't it? I mean, we don't want lawyers going around telling everyone the wrong thing.
But we do want lawyers to be encouraged to give people free legal assistance when they need it. So that's the countervailing position. Yeah, we don't want lawyers going around committing malpractice in advising prospective clients.
Competent free legal
assistance. Well, when you give free legal assistance, there is an attorney-client relationship. You don't have to pass money and all that.
So this is more the cocktail party or trying to see somebody on the street situation, not the dial a lawyer, right?
When you said this is fact-based, if you go back to comment D to section 552 of the Second Restatement of Torts, which is actually cited in the opinion below, they talk about there's this scale going from the so-called curbstone opinions to an actual... something clearer given the course and scope of one's profession.
Right.
And I guess the problem I have, and this is a criticism leveled at the third restatement by Mallon and Smith, who wrote the leading treatise, is that the rule articulated, especially in is at once overbroad. I mean, it's a broad encompassing duty, and yet it's fact specific. There may be a duty, but you really don't know what the scope of that duty is until you look at the particular facts. And this is even said so in section 15. Comment E says, well, what care is reasonable depends on the circumstances, including the lawyer's expertise and the time available for consideration. So the problem I have with the restatement, and I'm not the only one, is that it imposes this broad duty, and yet you really aren't going to know what care is. It's all fact specific. Not so much.
Doesn't that fact specific nature protect, actually, you know, the wholesale kind of problems you're worried about, the cocktail party, you know, the guy on the street, so forth?
But I guess what we would want from this court is a bit more guidance in that area.
Well,
I think the Court of Appeals opinion just sweeps too broadly.
Mr. Mann, if you look at comment D, they do seem to be trying to carve out sort of a pecuniary interest on the lawyer's part versus what they call just a gratuitous interest, right. I suppose. And so are you suggesting that somehow we ought to go along those lines, that if you're a prospective client and you're trying to get something, well, the duty is a little bit different than if you're just tossing off a comment at a cocktail party?
Oh, I think that's correct. Yes, I think that's absolutely correct.
Well, that's what the comment would suggest already.
Yes.
So what is your criticism of that comment then exactly?
Oh, I don't have any problem with that comment. I don't think we're disputing that there is a duty on the part of the attorneys to give correct information. The question is what is the scope of their liability when they're negligent in giving that information? Is it going to be limited as it is under the Section 552 of the restatement to out-of-pocket losses, or are they going to be allowed to recover a full expectancy interest just as though there had actually been an attorney-client relationship? I see that as really the
So really you would be, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but you'd be okay with this Court of Appeals opinion as long as we were to write a decision that said that if there was a negligent misrepresentation kind of claim, the damages were to be limited.
Yes.
That there's no factual basis at all for us to write that kind of, that would be advisory at least in this context. And wouldn't you agree with that?
Other than the claim in the complaint describing the main claim for damages, that is what triggered it. It's in the complaint as the claim for damages.
And let me just make sure. So from your perspective, your real concern is measure of damage, not scope of duty.
It is. They're kind of intertwined because if you have a lesser duty, you can't have a greater liability. If the duty to furnish information is only to make sure the information is accurate for the use in a business transaction, you can't be held liable for that, the expectancy interest in that business transaction. It's beyond the scope of that duty. And I would analogize that here, that when an attorney just gives legal advice, even to a prospective client, and no attorney-client relationship results, in other words, the client is not induced to enter into an attorney-client relationship, that the lawyer just cannot be held liable for the loss of the value of the client's case based just on that limited act of giving information. And it is a duty question. I mean,
I guess I always sort of thought that if one has a duty, the court, of course, it's a question of what the duty is, and then the scope of the duty, whether or not that duty was breached, which is another way to put it, is a jury question. You seem to be, and then damages are a question for the jury. Are we not using the same vocabulary?
No, I think you're right. It's just that the allowable recovery is also a question of law.
It is, and that's what I'm calling measure of damage.
Yes.
So the jury question is whether or not the duty decided by the court as a matter of law has been breached.
Yes.
All right.
How would you define the duty in this case?
Again, it would be based on Section 552 of the restatement, which is that where you have someone who will foreseeably rely on a representation in entering into a business transaction, either with the speaker, the defendant, or with third parties, that there is a duty to use reasonable care to make sure that that information is accurate. I don't think I've ever disputed that. But the question here is, what is the extent that you can hold an attorney liable to a non-client for negligence in those representations?
Well, I mean, I hate to quibble with you, but once the scope of the duty or the duty is decided, you would say that this particular lawyer in this case had a duty to act non-negligently, to not negligently misrepresent, right?
I don't think that's ever been in question.
It's not ever been in question?
No.
Okay.
I don't think the issue of duty is, I mean, I agree a lawyer has a duty not to mislead anyone, whether intentionally or negligently, and that includes not only non-clients, but the court, opposing counsel, and the general public. So I think that's a general duty, but can you bootstrap? The question is, based on that duty, can you bootstrap what is essentially a professional malpractice claim by a non-client onto that limited duty? Yeah, if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve whatever I have left for rebuttal. And again, I would thank the court for allowing me additional time.
A respondent will be given 30 minutes as well.
Well, that's 25, isn't it?
No, it's 30.
Well, it's 30 now. 30. We're going to 215.
Yes. Okay.
May it please the court, I would ask this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals and point out that...
State your name for the record.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I got all excited. my name is Paul Gordon. I represent the plaintiffs in the underlying case.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon.
My registration number is 21860. I would point out that the precise question before this court is not necessarily whether this is a negligent misrepresentation claim or something else. The precise question before this court is whether there are facts by which the plaintiffs may be able to recover. And what the Court of Appeals said was, yes, there are facts by which the plaintiffs may be able to recover, therefore we remand. Now, personally, I think the best way to analyze that, the best framework for analyzing the decision of the Court of Appeals is the negligent misrepresentation claim. But you're not bound to say that this is negligence or negligent misrepresentation or anything else. I mean, you could look at an element of the negligent misrepresentation claim and say, well, we've never had an opportunity before today to see whether these particular facts fit within this particular element of the claim, but today we're going to say that that claim should be allowed.
Well, what else would it be but negligence? You're not claiming that it's, you're not arguing that it's malpractice, are you?
I'm not arguing that it's a simple negligence claim. I'm arguing that it should fit, as my position, that it does fit within negligent misrepresentation. But the appellants have suggested that maybe there's some elements here that don't quite apply, and all I'm saying is, will you have the discretion here, given the posture of this case, to nonetheless find that there may be circumstances where the plaintiffs can recover.
So tell us exactly what that is based on your complaint. What's the duty? What's the damages? And what's the scope of the duty?
The scope of the duty is not to give negligent legal advice to a person, whether that person is a client or not. It's my position that the damages are out-of-pocket expenses, but given the context of a legal case, the out-of-pocket expenses would be defined by the loss in the value of the claim. If I, for example, have a watch in my pocket and it's worth $100,000, and because of a negligent misrepresentation to me, I sell it for a dollar, my out-of-pocket expense is the $100,000 minus the dollar. So,
well, but you would basically have to prove a case within a case, right? If
yes.
We accept your theory. Isn't
yes.
that right? So how is that different from professional malpractice claim? Seems to me the elements are identical.
The difference is we don't have to prove there was an attorney-client relationship, but we do have to prove that the client's or the person's reliance was objectively reasonable. So...
General ethical and malpractice principles, whether or not there's an attorney-client relationship and all those kinds of foreseeable things are really determined on the subjective basis of the client, not the lawyer, right? So haven't we dramatically expanded the whole concept of the lawyer-client relationship if we accept that?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
First of all, the issue of ethics is just a whole different world from...
Well, the restatement is essentially an ethical statement by a bunch of professors saying this is what it ought to be, right?
I respectfully disagree. I think the restatement is a summary of case law based on what those ethics, what those professors are sort of assimilating from their own interpretation of cases. But there's a big difference between punishing the lawyer for committing an ethics violation and imposing monetary liability on the lawyer. And reasonableness test for civil liability is objective, not subjective.
So what do you think the elements are of the tort that you're proposing? Negligent misrepresentation. What are your classic elements? Duty, which you've defined, and then breach of that duty by the attorneys giving false information or false or incorrect information, and some sort of reliance by the receiver of that information to his or her detriment, and then damages. Is that right?
Correct.
Would you add anything else?
No. I mean, it's kind of a philosophical question, but I've always sort of thought of negligent misrepresentation as just a particular kind of negligence. It's just that because of the unique circumstances, we want to flesh out the details a little bit better.
Well, misrepresentation, you have to have some kind of reliance, objective reliance.
Objective reliance, which arguably would fit within the causation element of the traditional claim for negligence. So honestly, I don't think you're expanding the law in any way. We still have to be careful. You know, lawyers can't drive down the street and run people over and say, well, I'm not liable because that person wasn't my client. We have responsibilities, and we slowly craft the boundaries of those responsibilities in light of particularized contexts, and that's the history of the law regarding the liability of lawyers.
But so, I beg your pardon.
I was just going to say, we're not doing anything particularly special or unique here.
So at a cocktail party, someone comes up and just asks you a casual question, you give incorrect information, it's possible that that information would not reasonably be relied upon, much like the restatement is suggesting. That would be casual or gratuitous information.
Exactly. That's the barrier to this great landslide of litigation that we would all fear against lawyers. I want to point out that in 1995, when Mahaffey was decided, the lawyers who were defendants in that case were making all these same arguments about this parade of terrible lawsuits that were going to come down. And they didn't happen in the last...
What was the barrier again? What was the criteria for deciding the difference between the casual advice and the relied upon advice?
A jury would have to find that the reliance was objectively reasonable. I personally don't think that the party versus the office environment is the difference. The difference between those two is, how much time do you spend educating yourself about the client's facts?
Wouldn't it be better if there had to be some kind of context that the lawyer and the client were actually perhaps looking at a future relationship that, you know, that this lawyer was expecting this to come back? I mean, after the workers' comp thing was worked through and so on. I mean, don't we need some other foundation for some sort of relationship?
I think that would be easier for courts to apply. I would agree with that. I'm not sure that it makes much of a difference. For example, you're sitting at a party and somebody starts telling you, well, you're a lawyer, aren't you? And they say, well, what about this? Well, the lawyer doesn't necessarily know at that moment that they're being wooed for a new case. And they don't necessarily know. When the client says, well, I've got a really good friend who's got this legal problem, what would you do? Well, it turns out it's the person talking to him. So, well, I think...
And that happens all the time.
That happens all the time, which I'd like to seize the opportunity to address.
But I think the lawyer has an interest in that case, because he knows that, or she knows that.
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct. Every single opportunity, every single cocktail party is an opportunity to bring in business. I lost track of it.
We're coming at you fast, I'm sorry. But you were going to maybe talk about this whole, whether there's a pecuniary or some sort of a financial consideration. Do you think that that's a reasonable way to put a limitation, or do you think this umbrella of objective reasonableness, the objective reasonable person standard, which we all love so much, is just going to be enough to take care of everything?
Actually, I remember what I was going to say.
Okay.
You were talking about how hard is it on lawyers to prevent themselves from getting sued under these circumstances? And the answer is, you say, I don't know. I don't know the whole story. I don't know that I'm getting all of the facts here.
Are you equivocating in some way?
Yeah. You just need to do more investigation, more legal research, and get the answer right. That's not a huge burden on lawyers. I don't think that the trying to draw a line based on financial interest in the case is going to be a workable line. But in this case, there clearly was. So you don't have to.
How do we know that from the complaint you filed?
Well, you don't from the complaint. And so I'm working very hard not to tell you the rest of the story. But I drafted the complaint in 2006, and I didn't have all these great ideas 4 years ago.
Well, can I follow up on your complaint? I guess the complaint doesn't state anything about the relationship between the attorney and the person in this case, correct? I mean, it doesn't describe the person as a prospective client or anything. And I guess I'm curious, your argument, I mean, you've been asked this several different ways, but how does the complaint satisfy the minimal relationship that's required? Can you point to something in the complaint that helps me find that?
I have two ways of answering that question. One is, to the extent that the allegations were made that it falls within the context of giving advice for use in a future business transaction, that tells you a little bit more about the context of the relationship. The second way of answering that question is, let's assume for the sake of discussion that we had failed to include a critical element that this court would say should be implied. Well, in 2006, we didn't know that that element existed, and we would just be learning about it in 2010. Well, this case was decided under Rule 12 standards. That means that if this had come up in trial, or in the district court, we said, we drafted our complaint this way, and the judge said, this is inadequate. We would have been given an opportunity to amend the complaint. And so if this court finds that there needs to be some other critical sentence, other critical allegation like this was a prospective client, then I would ask this court to remand it back to the district court and we'll amend the complaint.
Can I follow up, too, on I guess you're hanging your hat on negligent misrepresentation. You don't want us to adopt the restatement? Or can you help me with that?
I take no position on it because you don't have to adopt it to decide this case. And the restatement, I think, is a good restatement and should be the law in Colorado. But given that we didn't include an allegation specifically referring to prospective clients, I think that you can decide this case without formally adopting it. I would like you to adopt it.
And let me just follow up. I mean, I guess Mr. Mann's argument is that this really isn't a prototypical negligent misrepresentation case, at least how it has been applied in the professional context. I mean, typically what happens in these negligent misrepresentation cases is that the professional prepares something and somebody else is going to, a third party is going to rely on that. And you really, you're really not arguing that, right? The facts in the half year or any professional sort of opinion, whether it regards engineers or accountants, right? You're not generally arguing that fact scenario. Would you agree with me? It doesn't fit in the prototypical negligent misrepresentation facts, or tell me how it does.
I kind of agree with you.
Okay.
It doesn't fit in the half year. And it doesn't fit any other negligent misrepresentation case decided in Colorado. But I've spent hours reading negligent misrepresentation cases in other jurisdictions involving lawyers. And the pattern with which the cases are decided is the same. It begins to drone. And it sounds like this. Well, we don't normally impose liability unless there's an attorney-client relationship, but here's a scenario. And here's a scenario, and here's a scenario, and there's many, many different scenarios, right up until the point where the exception has swallowed the rule, and the whole reference to whether there was an attorney-client relationship is just one of many factors to take into consideration.
Well, I mean, I guess to follow up on Mr. Mann's argument, I just want you to respond to it. Aren't you just taking an attorney malpractice case and just kind of making the edges a little bit broader, right, to include more people? Now, we're not just including clients, we're including prospective clients.
No. And the reason I say no is because, first of all, what we're doing here is we're talking about the liability of lawyers, which has boundaries that existed before Mahaffey, regardless of whether there was an attorney-client relationship. Mahaffey was just the first case that came up in Colorado. So I don't want to accept or buy into the idea that what we're doing is expanding the traditional notion of an attorney's liability. What I would say is we look at the liability of attorneys the same way we look at the liability of everyone else. We have a constellation of facts. We have a constellation of circumstances. And we're not growing a pre-existing context. What we're doing is we're applying cases like Lyons and Taco Bell that say, when we're going to impose a duty, we're going to look at the totality of the circumstances and the burdens on the parties and the, you know, the burdens of not imposing liability. So one should define the question to refer to the history of imposing a duty. You start to recognize that we're not really changing the duty of lawyers in this context at all.
Well, except that we haven't expanded it to lawyers, correct?
Well, what I would agree is that this is a case of first impression, and to the extent that you impose liability, this would be the first time you do it under this kind of fact pattern.
But it's also correct, is it not, that you're sort of procedurally bound to be arguing this as negligent misrepresentation rather than some expansion of a malpractice claim because you didn't appeal the trial court's order with respect to the malpractice.
No, I don't agree with that.
Okay. That is what the Court of Appeals says in their opinion, is it not?
It's true that we did not appeal the negligence claim. That's true. But procedurally, where we're at here is the Court of Appeals says we might be able to prove facts entitling the plaintiffs to recovery. It doesn't say we're going to call it negligence, or we're going to call it legal malpractice, or we're going to call it George for all we care.
Wait a second. You didn't appeal that, so that's a dead issue. A professional malpractice claim, right? Unless the trial judge wants to reconsider it after whatever, 2 years.
We didn't appeal negligence. You don't have to decide this is negligence. But you also don't have to decide that it's negligent misrepresentation. My point is, the only thing you have to decide is that there may be facts that we can prove that would be entitled the plaintiff.
That seems very creative to me. And I guess what I don't understand is, are you reading the Court of Appeals' opinion as something other than discussing negligent misrepresentation, as broader than that in some fashion?
I think I'm reading it precisely. If you look at the language of the decision, the second to the last sentence, or the last sentence is, we cannot find that there are no facts under which the plaintiffs can recover. And that's the standard that was applicable to them under Rule 12, and that's the standard applicable to them.
Well, isn't that all in the context of their discussion of the negligent misrepresentation?
It is in that context, and I think that's the correct context. All I'm saying here is, if you think that there is some imprecision in the application of a particular element of what Colorado has historically recognized as negligent misrepresentation, you have the authority in this case to nonetheless fit these facts into the negligent misrepresentation.
Okay, but similar, but to the, not similar at all, but a different point, actually. If for some reason we're uncomfortable with the negligent misrepresentation claim, and we were to think that this scenario is best dealt with under a malpractice claim in terms of professional the responsibility, the duty of lawyers to prospective clients, we can't reach that in this context because of the procedural, because of the fact that the malpractice claim was not appealed. Is that your view? Or
Well, if I may turn the question just a touch. Let's say that you come to the conclusion that there had to be an attorney-client relationship, and that, in your view, that makes it a legal malpractice claim. And I would say correct. We have not appealed that issue. But the linchpin to that analysis is that you have to say, we think there had to be an attorney-client relationship. So it doesn't matter whether you fit that element of the claim under negligence or fit that element of the claim under the negligent misrepresentation claim. If you reach the conclusion that there must be an attorney-client relationship, then you must rule against the plaintiffs in this case. I think that answers your procedural question. I have nothing further.
Well, I'm concerned about the possible collateral damage here, so I might as well ask you the question since it's on my mind. We have pro bono clinics that are set up to provide limited legal advice, all right? There's not a traditional attorney-client relationship formed. It's done to help pro se parties, you know, maybe to navigate into court or in their personal capacities. I'm really concerned that what you're proposing here without any kind of sidebars on it, is that that people will not, attorneys will not engage in this kind of pro bono legal services for fear of running into this negligent misrepresentation tort. So I'll leave my concerns, if you will.
First off, there still has to be objective reasonableness in relying on the advice. That means that the lawyer who's giving the advice has to give quality time and do a quality investigation. Second of all, there's...
This is going to a clinic and people are walking in off the street and asking for some guidance, you know, some context, where to go, what to do, maybe help fill out some forms, some basic landlord-tenant advice, not the formation of a attorney-client relationship. That's my concern. You know, this is 50% of our appearances are pro se appearances. We're trying to get attorneys to help people with basic orientation to the legal system. I'm concerned about these people in a disappointed situation claiming the full freight of what they might have expected to get based on that one limited contact.
I would say that each of the elements of a negligent misrepresentation claim provide an adequate context in which to limit the liability of the lawyer. There still has to be negligence. There still has to be negligence in the way it's communicated. There still has to be objective reasonableness in the reliance. There has to be actual reliance. These are all elements that have to be proved, whether the advice is given in the context of pro bono work or not. The transfer of money is irrelevant to whether or not a lawyer can be liable for negligence in what you're discussing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mann, you do have a limited amount of time.
Just briefly, first I ask the court if you have any questions based on Mr. Gordon's argument.
I'm not quite sure exactly what you've conceded. And I'd like you to restate it.
What I can see, well, I have to say, I don't disagree with a lot of what he said.
Well,
what I would succeed is that, yes, a lawyer does have a duty to furnish information.
And can be sued?
And can be
sued. By a non-client?
By a non-client if it fits the parameters of the negligent misrepresentation tort, as the Mahaffey case.
And what do you think, what do you think the elements are?
Yes.
Let's try to nail this down. Are the same elements that I suggested to opposing counsel?
Yes, but the parameters are is that it is a much more limited tort. It's not the attorney in a negligent misrepresentation action does not have the broad duty of professional care that an attorney owes to a client. The attorney making a representation to a non-client has a much more limited duty.
If I were instructing the jury as to the duty an attorney owes a non-client for a negligent misrepresentation, you know, what would you want me to say?
Say that an attorney has a duty to exercise reasonable care to ascertain that the information communicated is correct. That's just a duty issue.
That's the duty. And I would say to the jury, you have to decide whether or not, you know, ex-attorney breached that duty.
Yes.
And whether ex-plaintiff reasonably relied upon that information.
Yes.
And then what?
Reliance caused damages.
Right. And then what?
And whether their damages are of the type that are authorized for recovery by a non-client in this particular tort.
So that's where I think you're putting your emphasis. And what is it we're supposed to understand specifically you want with respect to that?
Well, you know, as Justice Hyde points out, this is not the same as a happy situation, and yet conceivably it could fall within the parameters of that tort, except for the fact that what is being sought here is not out-of-pocket losses. It's being sought is the expectancy interest, as though a contract had been entered into with the defendant. They're trying to get the benefit of what they saw as a potential contract or potential recovery. That's an expectancy interest, and that's beyond the duty imposed under Section 552 of the Restatement for negligent misrepresentation.
Thank you very much. Thank both parties. You're welcome. We'll take a 10-minute recess before we call the next case.